It's a word we associate with Christmas, don't we? Peace. Peace on earth, goodwill to all men. It's one of those words that we say we want to experience. Who doesn't want peace? It's a word we say we treasure. Something we are willing to invest in. Now, why often is it so elusive? Why does it seem like a treasure that's just beyond our grasp? One of those things that even when we get hold of it, it somehow turns into water, trickles through our fingers. You see it globally. We say we want peace. From politicians to, well, you name it, people say they want peace. We see it locally. We see it relationally. We see that quest for peace even within the walls of our own homes, don't we? We want peace. And yet somehow, for some reason, it seems so hard to get hold of. Some people hear the word and they get different pictures in their mind. Do you? When you hear it, what comes to your mind? Some people hear the word peace and they got images of some peaceful meadow with a little stream and flowers and maybe some animals running around. Peace. Winter version, you know, add lots of snow, replace flowers with poinsettias, same thing. Peace. Others hear peace and they think of relational peace, unity, togetherness. They imagine that Christmas dinner, the one they've always wanted. The one where there's not the bickering and the arguing and the scrapping. Peace. At Christmas, we sing songs like that, like Away in a Manger. I was sort of looking around on purpose. It's one of those ones that gets the sway going, doesn't it? Away in a Manger. Peace. Or, oh, Little Town of Bethlehem. Peace. Our minds are filled with images of tranquility and serenity, both internal and external. There is peace. A friend of mine spent Christmas in Bethlehem a few years ago, and he's written a few books, and one of them he included his experience, and I'll admit it's forever shattered my picture of peaceful Bethlehem. He said, when I told people I was spending Christmas in Bethlehem, their typical response was, that would be magical. It wasn't. It was scary. Bethlehem's in Palestinian country. It's bound by a massive prison-like wall and constantly under the watchful eye of Israeli and Palestinian military police who stand ready to swoop in at the first sign of trouble and squelch it with brute and even lethal force. He said they spent Christmas Eve in the Nativity Square, and the police in groups of five or six shook down my teenage son three times just because of the way he looked. And on Christmas Day, we were caught in the middle of a street riot, stones flying past our heads, tires set ablaze. The police dispensed the crowd with tear gas. Merry Christmas. Said it forever changed my image of the birthplace of Jesus. Yes, I visited it more than 2,000 years after the events that made it famous, but much has changed, right? Or has it? He said, perhaps my idyllic and romantic imaginings of ancient Bethlehem obscured the reality that Bethlehem in Jesus' day was so much like it is today. A violent, suspicious, dangerous place, ready to turn away the very one who came to save it. Peace. Most dictionaries define it fairly similarly. They say it's the absence of war or the threat of war. A couple years ago, I read an article that said that there was a study published several years ago that took the 3,500 years of recorded human history and asked, in how many of those years has there been an absence of conflict? Basically, how many years have we enjoyed peace? The answer was 286. If you define peace as the absence of conflict, then we collectively as a human race have experienced peace less than 8% of the time. Peace. I wonder if maybe our struggle to experience it is because of the way we define it. Idyllic, romanticized, picture-perfect settings. Winterscape, summerscape, family dinner, whatever image. Maybe we don't understand it the way God wants us to understand it. Maybe there's something about peace we just haven't quite got our heads around, let alone our hands and arms around. What is peace? According to the Jewish world, peace doesn't focus so much on external conditions. It speaks to the status of the heart. That's what the video was trying to convey. There are more than 400 direct references to peace found in the pages of your Bible. The most common reference, if you dig back into languages, is the one that leads to the word shalom. Shalom. It speaks of health and wholeness, of harmony and completeness. It's not so much about what's going on outside, it's about what's going on inside. Shalom. An absence of war, an absence of conflict, that'd be great. But if you have shalom, you have profound peace no matter what's going on in your world around you. Shalom. That's peace. It would have been peace as Isaiah understood it. And yet, in the passage we were looking at last week in Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6, Isaiah used an image that has captured my attention for the last while. He refers to the Messiah as what? The Prince of Peace. Prince of Peace. I don't know if you ever thought of it this way, but that's taking two wildly different images and bringing them together in one title. We've talked about peace, shalom. What was a prince? In the Old Testament times, a prince was first and foremost a military or a political leader. He served alongside the king with the express goal of expanding the territory, of conquering new ground, of protecting the people at all costs. For example, 1 Samuel chapter 13, there's a time of battle about to unfold, and King Saul, we read, took 2,000 soldiers with him. What was Jonathan the prince doing? He took 1,000 soldiers with him and went in another direction. He's a prince. He was going to war. Or in Esther chapter 1, when there's a six-month-long celebratory feast that's being held with the goal of establishing the power of King Xerxes throughout the entire region, he invites all these different leaders of nations together, and on that guest list are the princes of Persia. Why? They were the movers and shakers in Persia. They were the power brokers in Persia. You wanted them there because these were the guys who knew how to get things done. That was a prince. Very different from our world today, at least those of us who are part of the Commonwealth, isn't it? We think of princes and what images come to mind? Toothy grins, big smiles, photo ops, pictures and tabloids and blogs, PR, public. I know there's more that goes on behind the scenes. But largely, a prince in our world is a royal figurehead. But in Isaiah's day, a prince was a warrior. He was a conqueror, a commander. And the mere mention of his name would invoke images of combat and bloodshed, not photo ops with toothy grins. So when you put those two images together, a prince and peace, it's an intriguing blend. Images of battle and combat mixed together with harmony and tranquility? How's that fit? There's a passage in Isaiah 42 that kind of outlines a little bit of what the Prince of Peace would look like. It's one of four passages, rather, where Isaiah paints a picture of Jesus. And I'm going to read it to you. It's found in verses 1 to 5. Isaiah writes, "Here's my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will bring justice to the nations. He will not shout or cry out or raise his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. In faithfulness he will bring forth justice. He will not falter or be discouraged until he establishes justice on earth. In his law the islands will put their hope." There's three images, three thoughts I want to draw out from that passage. And the first one is an image of Jesus as a peaceful warrior. A peaceful warrior. Notice that phrase, he will bring justice. Our world defines justice as the pursuit of fairness and equality. But in a spiritual sense, it goes much deeper than that. In God's eyes, justice invokes images of turning the clock back and going right back to the beginning of time. Back to the time before sin entered the world. Back to the time when there was no barrier between man and God. Jesus, the peaceful warrior, would come to earth and fight for the restoration of an uninhibited relationship between God and man. He would do whatever it took to reestablish peace. That's justice in God's eyes. It's personal, because personal sin is involved, but it's also global in that it reaches every corner of society. Jesus, the peaceful warrior. But notice the strategy he employs. I've read over this verse so many times, I don't know how I didn't see this. It says, he won't raise his voice in the streets. I like the way the message captures it. He won't call attention to what he does with loud speeches and gaudy parades. Now, hold on. Isn't that the way people get things done in our world? Loud speeches and gaudy parades? Isn't that like the way we do things? If you want to accomplish something in our world, isn't that the starting point for any leader of any organization? Rally the people, stir up the emotions, and then shout long and loud until you get the change you desire. Isn't that the way we do things? This is what I see every time I watch the evening news. During Jesus' day on earth, the Pharisees followed what I think is a very similar strategy. They waged their battles in the courts of public opinion. They gave long, loud speeches and asked people to watch them, drew attention to themselves. And although there were times when Jesus was blunt in the way he responded to them, he more frequently chose to engage as a peaceful warrior. And I'll give you an example. There's a story in Matthew 12. Intriguing story. Jesus is in the synagogue for the Sabbath, and a man approaches him with a withered hand, obviously looking to be healed. The Pharisees quickly take stock of the situation. And they know that this is a golden opportunity to trap Jesus. If they manage this situation correctly, if they draw attention, they make a speech, stir up the crowd, they could probably turn this to their good. They could trap Jesus. The crowd would turn on him. All they had to do was ask the right question in the right way at the right time. They needed to look at Jesus and find opportunity to say, where everyone could hear, is it right for you to heal a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath? They couldn't ask that question privately. They couldn't go to Jesus and ask him directly. They had to do it in a way where everyone could hear, because they were very much making a speech in the streets. It wasn't a parade, but close to it. They thought there might be one when they won. If Jesus would just respond to their question the right way, if he said no and then healed the man, those watching would know he broke the law. And he did it in front of everyone. If he said yes, well, the crowd would conclude that, well, maybe he didn't know God's law as well as they thought he did. You know, Jesus could have easily exposed their motives. He could have looked at them and said, "You bunch of hypocrites. What's with the sham? You're a bunch of phonies. You don't care about this man. All you're trying to do is trap me. You're just a bunch of dirty, rotten, low-life, overly pious phonies." He could have. That would have been quite the speech, wouldn't it? Instead of ridicule or a display of contempt, Jesus points out that every single person in the room has a heart. He does it by saying, if any of you found your donkey in a pit on the Sabbath, wouldn't you rescue it? How much more should I care for this man who's hurting and needs to be healed? Peaceful warrior. Waged a battle, but did it in a way that, very different from the Pharisees. Wasn't overbearing, didn't back down. He's a prince of peace. But a different kind of prince. It's the first image I see. There's more. Jesus is a gentle conqueror. That comes out in verses 3 and 4. Interesting image there. It says, a bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. When Isaiah spoke of those terms, everyone in his day understood exactly what he was talking about. We probably need a little help. In Isaiah's day, reeds were used for a variety of things. There were musical instruments, for example. They used them to make flutes. But if they somehow became damaged, they were broken in pieces and chucked out on a scrap heap. There was no tolerance for a bruised reed. It was deemed useless. As for the smoldering wick, people knew what happened when your lamp ran low on oil. It would start to smolder. Now, there was a couple of different ways you could address that. The easiest was just extinguish the wick, refill your lamp, relight your lamp, presto, you got light. The other route was to nurture it, to slowly fill the lamp with oil. You had to protect the flame. It took a lot longer. But if you nurtured it, it would shine brightly once again. Now notice the image Isaiah's painting of Jesus. He won't take a bruised reed and say, "You're useless." He won't take a smoldering wick and extinguish it. He'd rather just nurture it. Bring it to life once again. It's an interesting picture of a prince of peace, isn't it? He shows power and compassion. He not only leads the army in victory, he cares and supports those who are weak and those who are bruised. He cares for bruised reeds and smoldering wicks. That may be the entire message you need to hear this morning, because that might be you. You might feel bruised by the events that are going on in your world. And man, am I aware of it in our church family. There are a lot of bruised people right now. There are a lot of smoldering wicks too, aren't there? There's something that's taken place in your heart, and that fire that once burned is now barely a flicker. And you don't want it to go out. And the good news I'd share with you this morning is that you worship a God who specializes in bruised reeds and smoldering wicks. And he can't wait to see it come back to life again. Just trust him with it. He'll do it. It's his promise. He's a peaceful warrior. He's a gentle conqueror, but there's one more image. He's an unwavering commander. Take a look at verse 5. Isaiah says, he will not falter. He won't lose strength. He won't lose his footing. He won't trip and stumble and fall. He won't hit an icy patch and go whoop. He will not falter. He also won't be discouraged. He won't lose confidence. He won't lose enthusiasm. He won't have to say, I'm sorry, I'd love to help you today, but I'm having a bad day. He's unwavering. When Scripture says he's the same yesterday, today, and forever, it's a promise. He will not falter. He will not grow discouraged or downcast. Instead, it says, he will not falter or be discouraged, what? Until he establishes justice on earth. There's that word again, isn't it? Justice. That's a buzzword in our society. We want justice. The Prince of Peace has promised he will not grow weary, he will not falter, he will not be discouraged until he has established justice. And then notice the last phrase. In his law, the islands will put their hope. What does that have to do with it? English Standard Version captures it as the coastlands. Either way, it was a reference to the uttermost parts of the known world. Put it back into context. He will not falter or be discouraged until he establishes justice on earth to every corner of it. Unwavering commander. There is not one corner of our world that is outside of his influence and control. Not one hidden spot. It's an amazing promise for a world plagued by injustice, isn't it? Just as the zeal of the Lord Almighty will guarantee the arrival of the Messiah, the unwavering commander of heaven's army promises that he will not rest until suffering and abuse and poverty and tragedy are no longer a problem in any corner of this world. It may not happen today, it may not happen tomorrow, but it will happen. It's his promise. And he doesn't make promises he doesn't intend to keep. He's an unwavering commander. He will make all the things that are wrong right once more. Do you see the picture that Isaiah is painting? Interesting picture of Jesus, isn't it? He's the gentle, encouraging, justice-seeking, truth-protecting Prince of Peace. Make no mistake, he's in charge. But he's also the one who can heal the brokenhearted. The one who can breathe life into a spiritual life that's flickering. The one who won't toss you aside and declare you to be useless. The one who will gently pick you up and restore you. This is the one we're called to worship. This is the one who is called our Prince of Peace. This is Jesus. Paul Harvey once told a story about a father who received word on Christmas Eve that his son had been critically injured in a battle. He wasn't expected to live. And being a poet, the father, he sat down and started to write out his anguish in words that in time became a familiar song. And in despair, I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said, for hate is strong and mocks the wrong of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Yet, even in his grief, Henry Wadsworth Longfellow refused to let go of hope. And you can see it in the last stanza of that song. It says, then pealed the bells more loud and deep, God is not dead, nor does he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. Question for you this morning. Where are you living? If you were to define it as between the first and the fourth stanza of that song, where are you living? Is peace gone? Does it seem like it's a distant memory, or at least a fleeting one? Or are you still holding on despite all you're facing? I don't know what you're going through. God does. I invite you to hold on to peace this morning. Maybe your struggle's relational. Maybe it's medical. Maybe it's financial. Maybe you don't know where to go to find work. Maybe you're at the other end of life and you don't know if you're ever going to be able to quit work. Maybe you've lost someone you love and your world's been turned upside down. Maybe you're looking to add someone to your world and you don't know if your world will ever be right until they arrive. God knows exactly where you are. And this Christmas, he would remind you that Jesus is the Prince of Peace. And one day, you're going to enjoy that peace in a way that you never, ever would dare to imagine. But until that day, he wants to give you a taste of it. A taste of it. He can do that because his son paid the price to purchase peace that will last for all eternity. And so he offers it to us. Until the day that Christ returns, if you've invited him to forgive your sin and become the ruler of your life, you have the awesome privilege of experiencing a taste of peace this side of heaven. An old hymn writer said, "It's a peace in your heart that the world never gave. It's a peace the world cannot take away." It's peace in your relationship with God that has a way of leaking out into other relationships if you let it. So before you go this morning, I invite you to ask God to give you a taste of peace this week. I'm convinced he'll give it to you if you ask for it, because he longs for us to experience it. Would you pray with me?